I'm going to be introducing you to Ben Zalisco. Dr. Ben Zalisco has been a community organizer in the atheist community since 2006. He founded and led Secular Student Alliance chapters at Elmhurst College and the University of Chicago. And he mentored successive student leaders as a humanist chaplain. He went on to be the CEO of Sunday Assembly in Chicago, Church for Atheists. A scientist first and foremost, he earned a PhD in chemistry from the University of Chicago, where he worked for 9 years as a researcher, making novel molecules and studying membrane protein dynamics. Ben has appeared in public debates, blogs, TV, radio, museums, and lectures on a wide variety of topics. Last year, he made a big change to a dream career. He now lives in Washington, D.C., and works at the Pentagon as an analysis of DoD programs and strategy. His latest side gig is the podcast Beltway Science, conversations about the science behind public policy. Here is Secularism and Science and Institutions with Ben Zalisco.
Thank you, Emily. I was telling Emily earlier, I've been there with being, you know, your last year being a head of an atheist group. Student groups always have a really dear place in my heart. I've been really excited about coming here. Most importantly, the beer selection is so much better here than D.C. I have a bit of nostalgia for Spotted Cow beer. May not be anything special to you guys, but to me, it's just really good. You can't get it outside of Wisconsin. But actually, the biggest reason I'm excited is because it has been a long time since I was running a student group. Back in 2006, that's me with the horrible haircut. And here was Hemant Mehta, who's speaking tomorrow, who was one of our first speakers at Elmhurst College, back when he was just a lowly math teacher that started up this little tiny blog that I think now is still the biggest atheist blog. Is that true? Yeah. So I'm sort of excited to see what students are like now these days among the atheist movement and to see all the things that AHA has. I'm so jealous. When we first started up, so I grew up in Southern Illinois, and it was, you know, middle of the Bible Belt, so about 20% Catholic, 20% Protestant, 80%, 90% Baptist, and for those who have calculus, that's a lot. I'm very religious people. But I'm a fifth-generation atheist. I come back from a long line of godless communists, open American communists in the McCarthy era that were leading labor unions. So until I went to college, I never met another atheist that I wasn't related to. And come 2006, you know, this is the beginning of the new atheist movement that emerged with the maturation of the internet and post 9/11. And I saw all these student groups of different religious organizations. I was in student government at the time, and I thought that'd be really cool if there was an atheist group like that. And so I sent out an email. It wasn't until I got the flood of emails back I met my first atheist. That wasn't a Zalisco. So it was a struggle to get recognized as a religious college. And so we had to fight a lot of people just to be able to become a student organization. Built it up to something that people could find that safe space, find that community. I think it's really important. But things have changed a lot since then, especially for me. I've gotten to do science, gotten to go into Sunday Assembly. And now that I work at the Pentagon, I think about very big picture fundamental issues. So I'm going to try and zoom out quite a bit and think about atheism in a slightly different way. So let me see if I can. Okay, so I won't go there yet. I want to talk about institutions. We talk about atheists as being defined in the negative. It's kind of a strange thing that we all have this thing in common. We don't all come together because we don't believe in leprechauns. So what does it mean to be an atheist besides the fact that we all aren't theists, right? Well, if we have this atheist movement, we need to build something positive. What is it we want to reinforce? What is the world we want to build? What does the fact that we're atheists mean about what we're trying to accomplish here? And so I want you to think a little bit about institutions, what it means to be an atheist, and I'll start here. Why are you here? I mean physically in this room. This is a weird thing if you think about it. Ben Zalisco is not some super amazing expert that you couldn't see any other place. You could be home at YouTube watching Nobel laureates. You could have even watched my talk here on YouTube about a month from now, and I'll post this on YouTube. And then you could pause it, you could snack more, you could make noises, you could Google and see all the things that I said was wrong. You could be home doing your homework, you could be doing your laundry. There's so many other things you could do, and it was just about an efficient use of your time, or simply getting the content that I'm gonna talk at you, than sitting here in this room, you got a commute here, you have some danger of making awkward eye contact with somebody in the speaker. No danger of that if you're home watching YouTube. So why are you here? I'm not telling you that you made a bad decision. You made a good decision. But think about it. Why?
I love you people.
Thank you very much. But you were motivated. I just want you to think about that. Why is it special to be in this room with other people all facing the same direction? What does it mean that you committed these few hours of your day to think about atheism or to see what the student, what AHA is doing these days? There is an inherent value here that I want to think about, and just because it's very difficult to articulate doesn't mean it doesn't overwhelm all the better reasons why you shouldn't be here. So I'm going to skip that. So let's talk about the big one, religious institutions first. Let me first be very precise about what my critique of religion would be before I can talk about all the good things that they do, which is a challenge. Back when I was in college, it was always about the accommodationalists versus the confrontationalists. And I'm a confrontationalist. I was the hard-nosed, firebrand atheist. Still am. I don't really change my opinions, but this talk is not going to seem like that. So my critique of religion is that they make claims that are unjustified about the cosmos, about life, about humanity, most importantly. Unjustified at best, in clear contradiction with evidence, more often than not. They have a process by which they come to truth, which is a recipe for misinformation, which makes us make amoral decisions, the stakes of which are raised to infinity. So this is a problem. It is incompatible with the enterprise of science. So the problem with religion is the belief system. But you think about church, I like going to church. I've never been religious before. Just show of hands. Did anybody at any time in their life go to church regularly? Oh, right there. We have most of the crowd. So you guys know what I'm talking about. Or you had a lot of pressure from your parents, or a lot of pressure from family, or a lot of other reasons to go to church. And think about why that is. Churches have been around for a very long time. They used to be very thoroughly integrated with the government. They were the center of community life. 300 years ago, when you have a church and state that are thoroughly integrated, this is how we solve collective action problems. You know, think about climate legislation today. We can't all agree just to use fewer straws and we're going to solve things. We actually need government action, federal government action, to make something happen. Or we have a charity problem where somebody can't pay for the chemotherapy. Well, we could have a government solution to that. We could have a private charity solution. Private charity solution, you need an organization to bring everybody together to do that. So churches are really good at collective action. They're really good at community. Now, we have solved that through a number of different means since then, but back before the internet, before telephones, everybody came together to compare clothing at this time, to understand where they fit in the class structure, to see how their neighbors were doing, to meet people they wouldn't have otherwise met. Churches are a really important part of the community. Anybody here would say they're from the South? Not a lot. Okay, I'm from Southern Illinois, and I've lost my drawl, though you get me talking to another Southerner, and it'll come right back. In the South, it is very normal and polite to meet somebody, and the first thing you ask them is, what church do you go to? It's a totally normal thing, because it's a way of identifying who you are. Who am I talking to? Or it's seen as such a friendly thing. Of course, I'm just curious. I'm just asking you about your background. Not even necessarily judgmental. It's just ubiquitous in life, in those communities. They obviously are very involved in rearing children. One advantage, just go to church and you don't have to worry about your kids for a few hours. You drop them off in the basement of the church, they go play games with the other kids, they get to meet other kids, they often get to learn lessons from people we at least think are experts and good teachers, and just get out of our hair. It's an easy excuse to go to when you try to teach your children good moral values, that you just fall back onto Christian values. So churches have a lot of good to them. Another thing I think they provide value is ceremonies. We mark life by ceremonies. And I want you to think, if you were to cut religion out of your life, what would life look like? So this is the last paragraph, last sentence and a half of the Declaration of Independence. You don't get a lot of information without punctuation, capital letters. If you were to think about some of the most important memories of your life, do you just remember every moment in your life of equal value? Or do you have some kind of structure to shape at it? You think about times before and after a certain event. So some people might have small amounts of ceremony, add a few punctuation marks here and there. Ultimately, the shape of the punctuation mark is arbitrary, but that there should be some of them in there to help break it up. You might have something a little more elaborate. Some people would have a few more ceremonies than that. And really identify, what are the important parts of your life that you want to remember? How do we want to
teach our children, raise our family. And people can go a little overboard sometimes. So there's a happy medium. And I think that as atheists, especially people who are religious and were used to certain kinds of holidays, certain kinds of routines, certain kinds of friends that they would see every time at Christmas and Easter even, when you leave the church, you leave behind more than just your community, but just a routine, just the kind of events that you have. I, for one, love Christmas. Love it. I love the aesthetic. I love community singing, and you will see that later with Sunday Assembly stuff. I'm a big fan of community singing. I just think aesthetically, Christmas is awesome. But undoubtedly, if I went to midnight mass every Christmas and then I left that church, there'd be something missing, right? So I think as atheists, we need to figure out how do we solve that. And maybe it's about going more toward pagan solstice-y kinds of things. Maybe we need to think of things that are arbitrary. Maybe we just need more federal holidays. Who knows? But religion's really good at this, in the way they mark new life coming into the world. Baptisms are, they have a problematic history, but they're pretty benign. You have a bunch of friends together, you anoint godmother, godfather, which has a religious context, but also has a secular context, that these are sort of your secondary parents, your vice parents. But it's no problem, you're not hurting the baby. In South Asia, they do this thing where they shave a baby's head. And it has a religious context in the idea that you are removing the bad spirits, the sins from their previous life in those whimsy little hairs. And that's a similar ceremony with the bris for among Jewish children. But I think these two are interesting because they're so ubiquitous and compelling as religious ceremonies that people have tried to come up with a secular reason for doing them. So people still do the head shaving thing, even if they're not religious. And they try to justify it. They feel like, well, maybe it'll promote hair growth. So they try to come up with some reason, and that religious history promotes something that may not be scientifically all that legit. Similar thing with circumcision. Definitely promotes something that may not be too scientifically legit. And there are a significant number of non-religious people that engage in circumcisions based on some pretty shady science. Coming of age ceremonies with a bat mitzvah, confirmation ceremonies, you get to do a pilgrimage to Medina. We mark these different parts of our life really well with religion. And as atheists, we need to make sure that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. There's some good things here that are inherently good. Just because they have a problematic context, let's try and see if we can build a world where these are just a little bit better, where we have alternatives to these, or we leverage the religious history in making our new ceremonies. Which takes us to the institution of marriage. It's funny, I'm hanging out with a bunch of students here, many of which weren't alive during 9/11, so I don't know how much they remember the old gay marriage debates of even 5 to 10 years ago. But you think about these religious ceremonies and the debate they were having over whether or not to approve gay marriage. I'll ask you guys a question. Why weren't civil unions enough? Should I have a handheld mic in case I'm on guard? Yes. Why weren't civil unions enough? Anybody want to raise a hand?
Separate but equal.
So, but they have the same legal rights. Why is that a problem?
But they didn't. That's the problem.
Why isn't that the same? They have the same legal rights.
Yeah, until you actually go out there in the real world and talk with other people, they go, oh, you're one of them.
So that there's an othering, but not just the othering, but that there's actually a lower level in not being married. Now, if, I don't know why I'm still holding this, like I need to speak with it. The point is that marriage has some historic value, and that if gay couples can't be married, they're somehow second-class citizens. So that's kind of strange, right? That if you're an atheist, if you don't really care about the name marriage, why should we care if you don't have that name but you have exactly the same legal values? And that there actually is value in leveraging a religious history, which is kind of strange, right?
We have a question in the back.
I'll repeat what you guys said.
With civil unions, you could not make decisions, medical decisions for the person in their own property
differences. She mentioned that with civil unions that you couldn't make medical decisions. I'm saying that let's say you had a civil union like President Obama had when he was first elected that had every single right that people who are married have. Now, that may promote future political discussions where we say, well, you have a certain Republican supermajority, they're only going to give certain tax benefits to people that are married, not with civil unions. But let's just pretend there was a world
where the only distinction was the name.
The point is that you can leverage this religious history. Now, we have other ways of doing this. In taking some of the things that religion did kind of well, collective action, community, coming of age ceremonies, public recognition of a legitimate coupling. One of my favorite things about marriage is the idea that, you know, if anybody has a problem with who these people should wed, speak now or forever hold your peace. Sometimes that has a context of, you know, anybody know if she's not a virgin? Everybody's here? Everybody thinks she's a virgin? Okay, cool, now I'm okay, now I can marry her. That's obviously a problematic history. Another version was that in small communities, they wanted to make sure that the whole community supported this partnership because they were going to stop working for a little while as they went and had babies. And so the community demonstrated their support for that partnership because the men in that community were going to band together to make up for the lost productivity. It's kind of a beautiful thing, right? That the community supports this partnership. There's value in that history. So this is an institution that many atheists have allowed and set up, me too, as well as the institution of divorce. And I have lots of thoughts about marriage, and I think what would be valuable about this conversation and many others is our conversations we have afterwards. So you can pick my brain about that. There are other ways of leveraging this religious history. Unitarians are one of them. Anybody ever been to a UU church, Unitarian Universalists? All right, about half. Anybody know? So Bertrand Russell used to say about Unitarians that they believed in one God at the most. They're sort of religious in name only. The old joke of what do you get when you cross a Jehovah's Witness with a Unitarian? Somebody shows up at your door for no particular reason. I have family who are Unitarians, actually in Milwaukee, and we had Thanksgiving dinner with their Unitarian pastor, and she admitted after extensive conversation that the only reason they were a church was for the tax benefit. That ultimately, they were just a community with all the valuable things that I see in religious institutions. And I'm a fan. Now, if you're an anti-theist, if you're somebody who thinks that not only is religion false, that there are no gods, but that religion is a negative influence, you're not going to feel very comfortable in a Unitarian church. A lot of religious kind of dialogue, a lot of phrases that some people might say Einstein's God, that use God in a metaphorical context. There is preaching of Christianity as a good thing, whether it's true or not. And so it can make a lot of people uncomfortable being at a UU church. Another way that people have found community is through the internet. And this is what we see with the atheist community really growing, is that people found Reddit was their new home, or other kinds of blogs in their young times. Now blogs are now mainstream media. Another way is through student organizations. When I was running a student organization at Elmhurst, one thing you don't appreciate once you leave college is how easy it is to form a club when you're in college. You can just grab a conference room, not even just having a Haas budget, but just being at a nowhere school, you can meet in a dorm conference area, you can just grab a room because you're a student organization, you can get a few $100. It's really easy to build an organization. I don't think we've figured out how to do this well as adults. But we gave it a try. So Sunday Assembly was started in the UK, I think in 2012, by Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evers. And the slogan is live better, wonder, help often, live better, help often, wonder more. Basically, atheist church. So let's try and do the UU thing in a way that anti-theists would feel a little bit more comfortable. That really eschews the religious bits, but just has the event feel like a church. So we ran this in Chicago for 2 years. We'd have in a lot of rooms like this, or at an elementary school auditorium, or at a community center, audiences of 20 to 200 people. We would have a guest speaker once a month. We would meet once a month. We would have music. We'd have a band. That's me playing bass, the Beatles songs. We would have readings. So we had somebody read from A Pale Blue Dot from Carl Sagan. I did the poem Storm by Tim Minchin as a reading one time. Get me drunk tonight and give me 9 minutes, I'll do Storm for you. And we would try to do a lot of things that a church would do. We also did charity, we had side groups, sort of like a Bible study, but it would be something else. A lot of what AHA does, these small discussion groups outside. We would often do charity drives where people would bring glasses or business clothes to a Sunday assembly. This is one of our programs. I can go through some of the details. We'd often have themes of the songs. This was Irish Drinking Song Day. We would always have, we'd add Disney song themes a couple times. We also did a bit which was different from other Sunday assemblies around the world, which was Why Sunday Assembly, which is kind of a miniature version of what I'm doing now, which is what are we trying to build? Why are we doing the Sunday Assembly? And it was always very emotional. We would always have somebody talk about when they left the church, what did they leave behind? What friends never spoke to them again? What family disowned them because they left the church? And what home they found with Sunday Assembly? And often, you know, beginning when we have coffee and donuts or people came in the door, or when we go out to a pub after Sunday Assembly, there was a lot of consoling people, it was a lot of counseling, it was a lot of, I was raised in this context, how do I raise my children in this new context when they don't have their grandparents to go to? And so this is a really something that people can fall back on. We also know, because Sunday Assembly is in many cities, can I ask, anybody ever been to a Sunday Assembly? Oh, that's awesome. Is there one in Madison?
There was.
Oh, okay. Well, same thing with Chicago. So let's talk about why this is difficult to do. The problem we ran into with Sunday Assembly was manyfold. One is something that I encounter a lot with nonprofit work and volunteer work, which is that we have a lot of challenges with the umbrella organization, the International Sunday Assembly, wanted to charge us money for using their brand. They wanted to do a lot of things that made us very uncomfortable. Fortunately, we never ran into that because we didn't have enough money to run ourselves. Ultimately, things do come down to money. You may, especially when you're in a big city like Chicago, renting space is very difficult to do. And if you can't rent space in a prime location, you won't recruit the amount of members that can come there to give you the donations to keep your thing going. So we were at about 70% of what our business model needed to do to generate income. We lasted on a couple of very generous donations for 2 years, but ultimately we just can't collect enough. So how can churches do this? There's a church rule that generally you can't expect anybody to travel more than 10 minutes to your church, which is an interesting rule of thumb. Now, yet another thing we learned from what churches do in this space. Churches also have this kind of social expectation. I think that's the biggest problem we ran into. That there's this expectation that you just donate money to your church. That's the default charity. Especially with people that are elderly and have disposable income, they will give that money to your local church. But when I tell people that, you know, I'm representing Sunday Assembly, like, what is that? So we would use the phrase Church for Atheists on purpose because people know what that means, even though it's absurd on its face, right? There's this social expectation that we just expect there's going to be a church in the neighborhood. We expect that it's going to get a lot of money, especially from old people. Church also has the ability to guilt people into giving money and extract money and leverage people's afterlife and their eternal experience and the well-being and the standing of them in the community to be able to give them money. And that makes up the little bit of a difference. I would say I have learned, though, talking to other people that used to be church organizers and then helped Sunday Assembly, that churches aren't the cash cow that a lot of us think they are. There are certainly mega churches, but the vast majority of smaller startup churches are just pinching pennies. So whereas they have all this additional leverage on us, they can barely keep going, and churches are dying for the last couple decades. We don't really know how to do this yet. I don't have an answer for this, but I feel like as a community, we need to figure this out. Let's talk about another institution that replaced some atheist institutions. Coexist, interfaith institutions. So there are a couple of good things about this. One, obviously, anytime you have people from different mutually exclusive religious sects not killing each other, speaking civilly in a great organization, that is a good thing. I think another great thing about this kind of banner is that it recognized something atheists have been saying for a long time, which is that, yeah, they are mutually exclusive. They are in contradiction, so isn't it interesting that they are coexisting? This doesn't say combine, this doesn't say blend, this doesn't say compromise. This is about pluralism. It's a good thing, it's a reasonable way of looking at religions. But there are some challenges here. So when you have interfaith organizations, and I can't possibly generalize for all interfaith organizations, it's not even necessarily a thing, it's more of an adjective that people tack on to a kind of organization. When they celebrate what they have in common, what interfaith organizations tend to do is they celebrate that they all have a faith in common. Now that's kind of problematic for the atheists, isn't it? Many interfaith organizations, and certainly more recently than not, welcome atheists to the table. They can be members of these organizations, they can participate in the conversation, but there's a problem with the way these organizations are framed. And this this worries me a little bit, especially when you think about the religious history of the United States. Why do we have a separation of church and state? It's not, you know, yes, we were founded on Enlightenment values, we all like this idea, but mostly it was out of fear, because no religion had a majority in the early United States. The phrase separation of church and state was from a letter of Thomas Jefferson, which was adjudicating a conflict between the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists. Because before very recent history, Christians were something that you understood what that meant, but there were so many different sects that were very distrustful that they were willing to say, okay, nobody gets to be in charge of the government because we're all afraid of everybody else. Once you start to get a majority of people belonging to one religion, which is being Christians, that starts to get problematic for the minorities, and we've seen that over the last few decades. So, as the only person that doesn't count in the interfaith organizations, I'm just a little worried. I'm a little skeptical. And so, what I'd like to see these organizations do is, rather than celebrating what they have in common as being faith, celebrate what they have in common being humanism. Now, I have brought this up to many, many, many interfaith organizations, and consistently the answer is, but humanist means atheist. But wait a minute. You can be a Christian humanist. In fact, the name humanism, the title humanism, comes from a Judeo-Christian background. So kind of strange that they would think that. And I think this betrays something that I do see in a lot of these organizations. Again, can't possibly overgeneralize. Some of my greatest friends are members of interfaith organizations. I think that this betrays a tone that part of what brings interfaith organizations together is, yeah, we may be from different faiths, but at least we have a faith. At least we're not atheists. It's another thing that kind of motivates the phrase agnostic. I used it. I was in high school in a Bible Belt, small public high school, and I had a girlfriend that I was really excited about dating, and she found out from somebody who said I was an atheist, and she broke up with me and said, no, 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 I'm not an atheist, I'm agnostic. I'm agnostic, I'm nothing like those atheists. That's problematic, because I was, but the same thing. Atheism is a very broad umbrella term. But the point was, I was trying to find any way that I would avoid being an atheist. And what I did was I was betraying my brothers and sisters in the atheist movement who needed my solidarity. But we could all be on the same page here if we were all just humanists. Ultimately, that's what interfaith organizations say they're trying to do. Let's just make it consistent with the language. So I think that will spawn some good discussion. Let's talk about something a little bit lighter. So, tribalism. A lot of people are being critical of sports fans, especially among us millennials. That's just tribalism. All you're doing is rooting for different kinds of laundry. Even the players change every single year. You get these kind of absurd behavior from drunk sports fans. I don't agree. I think sports are great. I think sports fans are fantastic. I think it is an outlet for a natural tribalism that we primates have. And if there isn't a healthier outlet than sports, I don't know of one. Now, it's possible that really big sports superfans are somehow justifying tribalism with this. I'm skeptical of that. I think it is a healthy outlet. I think that every single one of these Cubs fans know, no matter how drunk they are, that this is a little silly. And I'm a huge Cubs fan. And I bawled when they won the World Series in 2016 because I was thinking my grandfather and my family. But I know that the Cubs aren't actually that different from the Cardinals. There's different cultures, but yeah, we all know this is a little silly. And I grew up by St. Louis, too. I was in it. I had cigarettes thrown at me as a little kid by Cardinal fans. But that's fine. This is silly. We all understand that this is a game. So people are critical of sports fans. I don't understand how people can be pro-drug, pro-THC, alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, and not think that this isn't a really cool drug, too. We have this dopamine response when we exist as a tribe, so let's make sure we have healthy outlets so that we don't start waging holy wars. Where am I on time? Let's see, we got half. All right, I'm going to breeze through some of this. I'm going to talk about science. This is what I normally talk about. So this is an unusual talk for me. I used to teach at the Field Museum before I moved out of Chicago. Institutions of science. One thing that religion does well is they codify a belief system. If I'm a member of this church, that means I believe this, 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 and this. Okay? If I'm a member of an organization, maybe I don't agree with 100% of what they believe, but it's a shorthand. Labels are very useful.
Just because I say I'm an atheist doesn't mean I agree with every atheist that has ever lived. I'm not necessarily branded with all of that. But I should probably agree with most of the atheists. Let's say 51%, and then I can adopt a label, right? Well, scientific institutions have to do this too, whether it be institutions of higher education. This is what justifies an educated individual, and I certify that this person is a bachelor of science, is a doctorate of philosophy, right? Museums do a good job of that too. But as we look back in history, we start to question the institution's validity when we see how wrong they were. So over here on the left, this is a painting from Charles Knight, a great paleo artist from the turn of the century. And he was just making the most accurate scientific paintings of his time that he could possibly come up with, which by modern standards are very wrong. This is back when we thought of T-Rex as this lizard-like creature. In fact, dinosaur means terrible lizard. Where you see this guy in the back, he's sitting up like a puppy dog, and his tail is dragging on the ground. That is not the way these guys look at all. Then we get back to when Sue is discovered about the turn of the millennium, and you get this Jurassic Park picture of a more active bird-like stance with a rigid tail, a more active jumping, running creature, go about 20 to 30 miles per hour, but a more active creature. Now, that's when Sue is posted here, in about 2000. But even over the last 20 years, we've learned that this is pretty wrong too. She's missing some pieces. She's missing gastralia, these belly ribs that would have been embedded in her skin. Her shoulder blades should actually be touching together. The angle of her ribs is wrong. And my favorite part has to do with her posture here. If you look at her knees, anybody notice something that's weird about her knees? Anybody want to shout it out? Something's weird about her knees. She's missing something that you have.
Kneecaps.
No kneecaps, exactly. Sue doesn't have kneecaps. Now, why do we have kneecaps? They're not for protection, they're about muscle connection. Yeah, leverage, exactly. So that your quad muscle is attached to your patella attached to your shin bone. What it allows us to do is this. And I'm a catcher, so I really appreciate my kneecaps. Sue didn't have kneecaps, so she couldn't support her weight squatting down very far. So why is she in that posture? Because it looks really cool. She's like active pose, she's really ready to run and jump and pounce. There's also other ways in which her skeleton is twisted. But this is one of those things about institutions that we have challenges with. Some parts of the skeleton are really well-established science. And you have to be an expert to know which ones. And the other parts are guesswork. And you have to be an expert to know which ones. So this is what I just want to get on a pet peeve of mine when we say science was wrong about something. A lot of science is filling in the gaps, and a lot of it is very precise measurement. So this is looking a little more accurate. Sue was just redone, which I have to commend the Field Museum for, because even going 20 years and then investing a few million dollars into redoing your skeleton to make sure it's perfectly accurate is really cool. So good on them. Just fun thing, because I'm talking science now. I'm not going to talk about dinosaurs forever. Notice the little... Let's see if I can do this with a laser pointer. Nope, can't. So there's a little tiny bone between her shoulder blades. It's a little thing. It's called a furculum, but you all know it by a different name. It's a wishbone. This is a giant chicken. So in the means of what we talk about science being wrong, back in 1990 when Spielberg was making Jurassic Park, he was talking to some paleontologists, and they told him, you know, we think some of these guys might have had feathers. And Spielberg didn't think that was very scary, so he left them off. Now we know that virtually all theropod dinosaurs were completely covered in feathers. Almost all. There were a few allosauroids that maybe not. But it's really remarkable. These guys are giant walking chickens. So you look, compare this to the Charles Knight, you see a much bigger difference. Media institutions, also very important to, you know, finding out what is true, to coalescing our beliefs. Now, this is something our generation hasn't figured out yet. 30, 40, 50 years ago beforehand, to be able to produce media, whether it be a newspaper or a TV show or anything, you had to have a lot of money, you had a lot of effort, you had to put forth a lot of risk. You had to put a lot of equity at risk, which meant that you made sure that you got your story right. So simply by being on the air, by being media, meant that you were a good journalist. And a lot of our more elderly people got used to that. So when you look at the stats of who spreads fake news on Facebook, it's almost all people over 50. Because they're used to, if you see it on a screen, it must have a lot of equity behind it, as opposed to some guy that just wrote it on their phone. So there are some generational divides. Not only do we need to find new ways to do these old religious institutions, these old
different institutions a new way. We need to find a way to mark what is valuable media and what is not. Finally, government institutions. So, as I said before, 300 years ago, church and state were the same thing, and that our collective action problem was solved not only by governments, but by churches. Now we solve them almost exclusively by governments. And we haven't really figured out how to do that well yet. We justly put a very high bar on what a government can do, because government is special in that they have a monopoly on violence. Government is the only entity that can kill you, and that's it. They have a lot of reasons why they have to do that, and we have to set up a very firm framework on how to do that. They're the only institution that can enslave you. Everybody know where this came from? I'm from D.C. I just assume everybody knows all this stuff. You talk to your CBS person about what they saw in Politico that morning. So why did Robert Mueller do this? Because there's a very high bar. Think about what the politics have been like for the last 2 years. Every Democrat in the country, we have to see what Bob Mueller says about President Trump. Every Republican in the country, well, I'll talk about that later once we see what Bob Mueller says about President Trump. I guarantee you Bob Mueller has a lot of opinions about President Trump. So why didn't he use that power? He could have said anything he wanted, and he's been given all of this equity, all of this power, and he didn't use it, because the institution is more important than his individual power, right? And I think we need to have a new appreciation for institutions right now. I'll skip this part. I'll come back to it if there's an issue. Another thing you might have noticed, I only ever call him President Trump, because I work in the Pentagon. I have my opinions. I've been a political junkie since 1992. I was 5 years old at a Clinton rally, and I was 17. I was working 40 hours on a political campaign. I couldn't even vote. I came up in 2004. I became politically mature, opposing the Iraq War. You guys, looking forward to the next presidential election. 2004 crushed me. I had no way, I couldn't imagine President Bush being reelected. He was unpopular. He had two wars done a horrible job of, that he had lied to the country about. How could this possibly happen? It crushed me. So prepare yourselves emotionally for 2020. But think about it. 4 years after that, we got Barack Obama. Think about things on a much bigger scale. It doesn't seem quite so consequential. Now, when I was in college, so anybody read The Moral Landscape by Sam Harris? It's fantastic. It's fantastic. It's the clearest way of painting a picture of consequentialist philosophy. It kind of frustrated me because he said it, what I was trying to say, so much better than I could ever possibly have said it. It's the idea that all possible choices exist on a landscape of well-being, and that we choose these peaks on this landscape, and that, you know, you can model the universe. All of this is in the realm of science, so we need a science of morality. And then I got the job at the Pentagon, and my job is basically to do that. To model the universe and find the most moral decision. How do we make programmatic and strategic choices based on science? Which is sort of a big, okay, smart guy, have at it. Have some fun with that. You think you can model the universe? Have fun. And you start to appreciate that, yes, I'm still a consequentialist. I still believe that non-overlapping magisteria is absurd. I still believe that there should be a science of human morality. I am still all these things. But ultimately, sometimes we have to be Kantian just for pragmatic reasons. How do you have a foreign policy without just following established game theory rules and following more Kantian-type ethics? And so I've seen that even though I haven't changed my mind, there's a pragmatic side to all of these deep philosophical arguments. Let's see, a quick cheap plug for my podcast. If you want to select the QR code, this is me and a few colleagues who are PhD scientists that work in the federal government. And we talk about the science behind public policy. If I have any advice for the students, if you guys are trying to build new institutions, if you're trying to be community organizers, study religion in the same way that Coke studies Pepsi. Study how they've done it, because they've been doing this for a very long time. How do you do this thing, you know, just in your spare time with volunteers? There are a lot of tips and tricks of the trade, but also be wary that you don't adopt the things for the wrong reason. We did a podcast recently about combating misinformation, and there was an article that said, basically, how do you combat the misinformation that uses, fallacy A, B, and C? Make sure you use fallacy A, B, and C to combat that misinformation. And it's okay in your hands because you're telling the truth. Make sure that you're doing things for the right reason. Also, if you ever heard the phrase, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go together, or if you want to go far, go together, right? Well, I'd say if you want to go as a volunteer in your spare time with the organizers, find a charismatic leader. Leverage charisma and try to get people to be there for different reasons than the way you're trying to recruit them. A lot of these basic kind of lessons don't work so much when you're just doing things in your spare time. Also, set short-term goals. Your organization probably won't last very long, even as much as you might like to plan for it being around indefinitely. Pace yourself. I'd also say if you want to do cool things in life, say yes quickly, and then be prepared to do a lot of things you shouldn't have said yes to. Sometimes you just got to try a lot of things, and you'll learn about a lot of different things. Guys, have any questions, I'd be happy to carry on conversation.
All right, and then just wanted to remind you all, make sure you have the mic before you speak, please, for our recording purposes.
I'm happy to say we started Oasis 5 years ago next week in Kansas City, and it's doing wonderfully. But I agree with you, it's incredibly difficult. If you could give someone some advice about how to deal with the failure and come back and move on to the next institutional, I'd be interested in your, because you've done that, obviously.
Yeah.
Maybe you could enlighten us a bit.
Yeah, question about how do you deal with failure? I would say that starting over again is the best way to deal with failure, because one of my other pieces of advice is that don't fight your last organization's battles in your new organization. And in fact, that's been the biggest problem for me, is that let's say the last organization had a lot of drama because everybody thought I was too heavy-handed. And so I'll go into the next organization, I'll be a little more conservative, and it won't move because it needed me to be more heavy-handed, right? Or vice versa. And so I feel like the best way to deal with failure is pick yourself up, and you'll find, oh my God, it's a completely new story. It wasn't me in the first place. It's just about the context. When you deal with sort of volunteer organizations, nonprofits, they're so small that each is so different, you will get a whole new perspective, a whole new value out of that new organization, and you won't be burdened with any of the garbage you dealt with in the last one.
Okay, so for the very end there, you were talking about if they use, you know, they're using fallacy A, B, and C, and you were saying, well, then you should also use fallacy A.
You shouldn't.
Okay, I was confused then. All right, fantastic.
This was this article that we read that was a guy that was saying that. Basically build a narrative, and that once your narrative, you are hijacking people's mind. Now, there's one thing about being a good communicator. There's another thing about trying to influence people in a way that is not evidence-based, or that is not reason-based, that is just trying to leverage their emotions.
Okay, so there's
value in that, but then you just have to be, with great power comes great responsibility. If you're a good communicator, you don't use that for evil.
Okay, so I guess essentially what they were saying was that, you know, intentions are really the most important thing, and you're disagreeing with that intentions aren't everything when it comes to the situation. Okay.
I would agree. Yeah, so here's a good point. Here's a good example. So let's talk about faith. When I say that I have faith in your capability to be a good person, right? What does that mean? Now, let's say I don't actually mean that in a colloquial sense. I mean it in a religious sense, and that I have actually no evidence. Let's say I've just met you, and I have faith that you're a good person. It's not a bad thing. I'm saying that I have confidence in you. That's a good thing. But I'm also empowering the idea that that's how we should judge people, as opposed to on the evidence, as opposed to what the evidence suggests that you will do in the future, right? So I'm empowering a bad way of thinking.
I've been a member of a couple of informal atheist groups, and interestingly enough, there have been participants in at least one, perhaps two of these groups that were not disposed to approach things from a scientific perspective. So one of the concerns I have, when I was really happy when you flashed the humanism thing, the American Humanist Association and humanism as a formal group, at least nominatively, if not always practically, gives precedence to the scientific method and critical thinking. But I don't think that's something we should assume is rampant in the atheist community. So what's your thought about that distribution and how to approach it?
So there's a few pieces there I would tweeze out. I wouldn't say that necessarily AHA, no affiliation with this AHA, the American Humanist Association, stands for humanism
necessarily. They are a humanistic organization, but you can use the title humanism to mean other things. I don't think an interfaith institution that decides to call themselves more humanist is necessarily bringing on any baggage of AHA. But as to your point about atheists not all thinking the same thing, I mean, Stalin was running an atheist institution. I think, of course, that there are lots of atheists that don't think that way. There are lots of ways to be a bad person. One of them is to leverage religious faith, but it is not at all the only one out there. And so if you don't have religious faith, if you're an atheist, well, then you're probably not going to be leveraging that to do bad, but there are a lot of more ways to do it. So, yeah, just because you're an atheist doesn't mean you're a good person.
Or a science person.
Or a science person. Same thing, right? You know?
Thanks for your talk. I'm wondering if you could just clarify a little bit about what is, in your mind, the difference between like the institutional message of an interfaith group versus the institutional message of a secularist group?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
How would you differentiate the purpose of an interfaith group versus that of a secular group?
Well, the purpose is going to depend on what the organization says they are, but so let's just hit on the only information I'm given in that question, which is, what are they called? So if you're an interfaith group, if we just tease apart the language, that means between faiths. So it's exclusively everybody but those that don't have faith, double negative there. So as opposed to an atheist group, which is going to include atheists. I don't know about you guys, I don't know how it works, but when we ran an SSA at Elmhurst College, we had more religious people than atheists in our group. Just people that agreed with us and wanted to learn from us and wanted to make sure we had support because they saw how we were treated by other people. So interfaith groups, I don't know if that's how they see atheists. It's going to depend from organization to organization. But if you have an interfaith organization that wants to include everybody equally, I think that the interfaith label isn't consistent with that.
Forgive me, I'm putting together a few thoughts here. Sometimes when it comes to sort of what a lot of us see as a political crisis that we're in, and given your current job position, in other countries, they often look to the military as a stabilizing force, and that's how you become a kind of a banana republic. It's frightening to me that somebody like yourself, as educated and well-spoken as you are, is in the military institution, which we sort of look to in this political climate as the backstop to this nut. And there's a question in there somewhere.
I'm going to give you back the floor, but you've reminded me of so many things I wanted to point on. One thing I trailed off before, I mentioned I only ever say President Trump. Why is that the case? I talked about my political history, you guys know what I believe. But ultimately, I don't have the liberty to have a lot of those political beliefs. I work in the Pentagon, and in the history of human civilization, the people with the guns have the power. It is so important in this country that that's not the case. I will do whatever the president says to the extent that I am in the Trump administration. Because the president is elected by the people, and you guys have the power. And so you get a really different perspective, you know, from shouting into the wind as a political activist, as a political campaigner, to working in the institution, and you have casualties in your Excel spreadsheet. You know, let's make sure that we get the fundamentals right. And one thing I appreciate from my point of view is that the vast majority of the government, you guys don't care about. It has nothing to do with politics. Let's just get the hardcore things straight. And most of the world is incredibly envious of our institutions. Our institutions are so robust. And you may be surprised that there are a bunch of scientists that work in the Pentagon that are just given liberty to, okay, how do we make this better? There are a lot of us. And we have considerable influence over the process. And when we come up with ideas, we have ways of getting into the process. Oh, just say one really important thing I forgot to do and I want to make sure I'm legally okay. I do not speak for the Department of Defense. I do not speak for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, all opinions on my own. There we go. We got to make sure we got that on tape. There are a lot of scientists in government. There are a lot of people that think evidence-based policymaking is really important. But ultimately, you want to stand up in institutions. That's what my talk is about. And we've heard a lot about that recently. So I'll let you get to your question. Maybe you thought about what it wanted to be.
The other concern is that there's only two kind of technical scientists in the entire House of Representatives, including the Senate. So again, we're falling back to the military to be the stop to someone who's nuts, instead of another institution which probably should have more qualified people in it, like yourself.
So I'll say one thing about the House. Last question, I guess. King for a day. What do we need? I think the biggest thing in the legislative branch, way, way more money to congressmen and senators. They are so dramatically understaffed. It is ridiculous. The fact that we have two scientists in Congress, we need more staffers. I don't even care so much about the representatives themselves, but they are so underfunded, even personally paid, because they have to maintain residence in their district, as well as live in D.C. some part of the time. Even though they make tremendous salaries from an objective point of view, what's demanded of them, we need to be dumping money at them. And it's really hard politically for them to pay for raises for themselves or more money for their staffers. So that's my personal political opinion from the inside, is that they are too stingy with giving themselves money. And so if we had more educated staffers, we had just more staffers, we wouldn't have to rely so much on the executive branch. So one other misconception about this is that every executive institution, like the military, is under President Trump, and then you have the legislative branch over here. That's not right. The right way to think about it. Department of Defense, HHS, DOD, DOE, all these institutions, they are governed by both the legislative branch and by the executive branch. We have direct congressional mandates to do a whole lot of things. And you might have heard on the news that the president has discovered he doesn't have quite as much power as he would like to have. That's because, yes, we're part of the executive branch, part of the administration, but there are so many different things that are congressionally mandated. We're just sort of the career government. And I'll tell you, from somebody who has a partisan background and a scientific way of thinking about it, even though I have a partisan background, I'm mostly annoyed by partisanship, because so much of what we do has nothing to do with partisanship. We just get pulled from different directions to do weird things, because people have generic directions they want the government to be going, and we just mostly want them to shut up and let us do our jobs. Yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have for questions.